Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. I was once expelled from the Siberian penal colonies for cruelty. Then I joined the Legion and rose from the ranks. A few months ago, a good friend of mine, John Tibbetts, was visiting me from Kansas City. He was out here for an Edgar Rice Burroughs to-do. And one night he said, hey, come over with me and Hugh Munroe Neely to see our friend Tracy Gosell. And I did not know any such person. And John said, oh, you will like her. She is writing a book about Douglas Fairbanks, and she has a large collection of Fairbanks posters and ephemera. So I went over with Hugh and John, and indeed I did like Tracy. Not only is she a very likable person, but she is incredibly knowledgeable about Fairbanks and his world. And the collection that she showed me that night was eye-popping. It was memorable. So we immediately started discussing the possibility of her appearing on the Commentary Track. And because Tracy is also a surgeon, as she says in her side job, it took a while for us to find a time that was mutually beneficial for us to get together. But we finally did it. And boy, am I glad we did. We had a wonderful time. Now, not only is Tracy's place filled with wonderful Douglas Fairbanks material, it's also filled to the very brim with dogs. She has somewhere between 5 and 50 dogs. Probably 5, but they are great. I love dogs. We had a wonderful time visiting with the dogs. And probably throughout our interview, you will hear the dogs at one time or another. Tails thumping on the floor. A couple of times loud snoring, which I did my best not to take personally. And every once in a while, Tracy would say, what should we do about these dogs? And we just let them go. So between Pecker the Rooster next door, crowing his chanticleer hello to you, and the dogs you will be hearing, this is a very animal-friendly podcast, but it's mostly a Douglas Fairbanks-friendly podcast, and Tracy knows everything about Fairbanks, and so we had a great, great, great talk. It's a very long talk, too, so I will shut up now and leave us get to it. So please enjoy this visit with Douglas Fairbanks authority, Tracy Gosell.
When I was 11 years old, my family was traveling on, I think, a business trip of my father's, and we got stranded in the Albany, New York airport, and plane was canceled, killing time, so I wandered over to the bookstore. And staring up at me was Lillian Gish's face from the cover of the movies Mr. Griffith and Me. And I convinced my mom to buy the book so I could wait, and that was the beginning of a lifelong passion.
So it was silent film that got you from the beginning?
Yes, I think talkies are a fad. They're not going to last.
Yeah, I agree. That's okay. Yeah. I see them dying day by day.
Yeah, I agree.
So after, I mean, how long did it take you to start honing in on Fairbanks?
Oh, Lordy. Well, I always enjoyed Doug. Some of the early films I bought, you know, the Black Hawk 8mm films that a kid could afford were the early Coat and Tie Fairbankses, and then I got an 8mm print of Thief of Baghdad. That was probably when I was in 10th grade. As a collector, I started collecting about 20 years ago and tried to collect very broadly and discovered over time that unless you were William Randolph Hearst, you couldn't collect everything of interest. So I decided to narrow my collecting to Fairbanks Sr. Also, in part because he was more affordable than Chaplin and Keaton. And Gish is pretty rare. Hard to find Lillian Gish pieces.
So you really started your interest in him as a collector.
He'd always been absolutely one of my favorites on film. But as a collector, I started obtaining things that caused me to find little pieces of his life that hadn't been referenced in the past or that had been misunderstood in the past. And so eventually, by the time I got to getting his love letters with Mary Pickford, I realized it was more of a story than had been written before. And I decided to buckle down on a 10-year project and write his biography.
How many has it been, 10 years so far?
No, it's been about, I think I started in 2006, 2007. So I have a few more years to go. And believe it or not, I've got a lot done. I've totally written the theater years, 1902 to 1915. And I've, I'm writing out of sequence. I've got The Poor Man bumped off. He's dying already. I'm just finishing up.
Spoiler alert.
I know, yeah. Alas, I have to tell you that Doug does succumb. I've written his death scene, and I've written from mid-1929 just about up to his death. I wrote the death chapter early because it was sad. I wanted to do the very end years before I did the really, really fun stuff, because if I wrote the story, I apologize, there are dogs in the background, one of whom's named Douglas, but if I wrote the story in the order that it happened, I think I would become a depressive, because the last 10 years were really tough. But writing it sort of out of sequence is much more cheerful an endeavor.
Well, we could talk about the story out of sequence too, because I've always been curious. I know that the movie business is a hard business, and
yes,
the transition to sound was hard on everybody. But I've never quite understood why Doug plummeted so quickly and died at such a young age, relatively speaking, especially since he'd been this paragon of fitness and health and good nature and all that stuff. He was he even wrote books about it.
Right,
about,
absolutely.
You know,
or
Laugh and Live.
Or had them ghostwritten by Kenneth Davenport.
Yes.
The answer of his early death I can speak to medically, and I do speak to it in the book. The reason, for example, Social Security back in the 30s was started for people when they turned 65 is that the majority of people didn't live to 65 back then. The death rate in the United States is 100%. If we start curing heart disease, we're going to increase our cancer deaths. As we cure cancer, then we're going to have more Alzheimer's cases.
Sure.
So Fairbanks had, and I am speaking as a physician here, which is my side job, Fairbanks had a heart attack, and it's the sort of heart attack that would be today survivable. They would have taken him in, done a cath, put in a stent. But in 1939, he survived the initial event, but then the clot that had occluded and blocked the blood supply of his heart to the main part of the left ventricle, which is the pumping part, probably dissolved on its own about 48 hours into the event. When that happens, freshly oxygenated blood comes to tissue that's not yet dead. If it were dead, it'd be no problem. But if it's dying, it's irritable, it's what we call ischemic, and the heart wiggled and fibrillated, and he went like that. So he actually had a perfectly lovely death. He had enough time to say goodbye and to talk to his loved ones. But he had a very premature death of something that would be absolutely treatable today and reversible. And he smoked. And I'm sure he ate a high cholesterol diet. And
didn't everybody in 1929?
Yeah, 39. Right? Absolutely. I mean, it was. I have cigarette ads from the 50s that, you know, tobacco is smoothing to your throat and smoothing to your nerves, and oh my goodness, it's so darn good for you.
Sure, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend Lucky.
Yeah, that's right. And he, matter of fact, he advertised for Lucky Strikes. If you look over my shoulder, there's the original painting on which the Lucky Strikes ad in 1929 was based. But he also advertised for Camels and other cigarettes over the years. And he was a chain smoker. I mean, he would go from one cigarette to the next.
I know that there was not as much of an awareness of how smoking affected people. But nevertheless, people knew, and a lot of people, you know, you'll even see in movies in the 30s, somebody will cough and he'll say, oh, I got to give up these gaspers, you know. Or they even call them gaspers.
Yeah.
So they kind of knew. And for a guy who lived like an athlete, basically,
but he,
for the longest time, is so strange to me.
Well, no, because...
But then again, I mean, I've known dancers, too, and they all smoke.
Well, yes, because they want to be skinny. Cigarettes, we did not... Lung cancer used to be a very, very rare thing. Doctors only saw it in, like, chimney sweeps. And it came into its own after World War I when all the soldiers were given free cigarettes at the front. And so people would talk about smoke as irritating the throat, but they didn't have an understanding of the effects on people's heart and lungs in the mid-30s. It was 20 years or less after the war. There hadn't been the long-term consequences of a large population smoking. He didn't drink. He was abstemious. He exercised religiously. And at the time, many people, you know, nicotine, they thought, kept them alert and bright and thin, sure. And you smoked a little more, you lost a little weight, and you felt better. So he also remember the last 5 years of his life, he wasn't entirely a paragon of health. He had some elective surgery. I think it was probably for a hernia. People are closed-mouthed about it. And he was having angina. That was being characterized by what he called indigestion and some shortness of breath episodes. So there were warning signs if there had been a good doctor. But think about it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in florid congestive heart failure near the time of his death. That was his hypertension wasn't being treated, and he was president of the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, different standards and understanding of disease then.
Yeah, my father had a heart attack at about age 50,
mm-hmm.
and the doctors put him in bed for a month.
6 weeks, yeah. Yeah, and now we don't do that because they throw blood clots.
Sure.
Yeah, it's actually the worst thing you can do.
And my father was ill for the rest of his life and died at 65, but it was, I've always thought back on that, of seeing him sitting in bed all frail and...
Yeah.
Everything, and I think now.
And Fairbanks was livid that he was going to have to stay in bed for 6 weeks. He couldn't hear the war news. They took the radio away. I'm sure that raised his blood pressure and agitated him more than if they'd just treated him as they would today. But
well, you said you started working on the theatrical stuff first.
Mm-hmm.
We're leaping around like a Citizen Kane here.
That's okay.
So I'm curious, as a researcher myself, where are you going? Because obviously that's a period of his life for which there got to be no survivors.
Indeed, although there were letters that people had not examined fully. So I have some accounts of him for example, finding his old childhood drama teacher on the streets of New York in 1902 and lifting her up off of her feet in a great big hug. There is some documentary evidence of things that happened. He will tell narratives, for example, of taking boat trips during this time. And, oh, he went and walked across Cuba with a cowboy friend who'd never been in the big city. Well, in fact, if you study the ship's manifest, indeed he did go to Cuba, therefore I suspect he walked across it, but he did it with Elmer Booth.
Ah.
Elmer Booth had been with him in 3 stage plays, and then, as you may remember, was a Biograph actor.
Sure.
Died tragically. He's best remembered as the Snapper Kid in The Musketeers of Pig Alley. Well, it's clear that Doug and Elmer were really friends, and this is something that people aren't aware of, and the clue comes by studying the records and finding the ship's manifests, you know, this one dramatic trip across the ocean. Well, yeah, but he went with his mom. You know, not quite as heroic as he would have you believe. Now, that particular trip where I found the manifest, I have to give credit. Booten Herndon, 30, 40 years ago, had found the same thing and already published it. So I can't claim a big win on that one. But nevertheless, there's a lot of evidence of what people were like and what they did.
What kind of sense do you get about how good a stage actor he was?
He was very natural. And it's important to understand that Very Natural in 1910 is still a far more studied, far more gesture-ridden form of acting than we think of today. His natural charm came through, but the influence of Frederick Ward on him was significant. And you will find, as his films become more formal in the 20s and grander, the more he reverts to actually a theatric style of acting. So in Robin Hood, when he's come up with an idea, his finger goes to the side of his nose. He will throw his arms out in grand theatrical gestures. But he's doing it intentionally. And when you hear his voice, as Brownlow has recovered it from those recordings from The Iron Mask, the prologue,
yes,
you're hearing a theatrical delivery style, a verbal style that's very grand and very formal with a lot of rolling R's. Now, when he is playing a hero in Remote Times, he'll go, he'll roll his R's. But when he is playing a young man in 1912, in a play that takes place in 1912, the critics speak to the naturalism and easy charm of his performance. The other characteristic of his performance was his athleticism. Everybody writes about that, and in fact, little newspaper clippings and articles really emphasize it. If he gave a show in, I don't know, New Haven, the Yale students after the fact would make him stick around and have him leap over chairs and walk up and down on his hands, because they remembered him doing it when he'd been in town the year before, and word got around and they loved him. So he combined that which was going to not only characterize him in films to come, but make him unique, because to have somebody so talented athletically and yet so handsome and so charming was a combination you didn't find. Most of your brilliant athletes in films were these clowns, you know, the Chaplins, the Keatons, who were phenomenal athletes, particularly Keaton. Could do all kinds of amazing things. But they were cartoon characters in terms of how they presented to themselves. They were never presenting themselves as romantic heroes. To have a phenomenal athlete who is a wonderful light comic, who is also the leading man, was a combination that's not really been done, even to this day, quite well by anybody else. Sure. They'll get 2 out of 3, but they never get all 3.
I've always thought, and this is probably not an original thought, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that Fairbanks was Harold Lloyd until Harold Lloyd came along to be it, and then Fairbanks says about the time Fairbanks started to transition to the costume roles, and because he was in those early films for the first several years, often a go-getter, a
yep.
real American
yep.
kid.
I'm trying to think of the differences, and because it seems like there were some differences.
I think self-confidence is the big
thing. Yeah, I think Harold was always reaching to be something and was a cheerful, affable failure until he yeah. found his courage, etc. Fairbanks' persona never lacked the courage.
Yeah. There's no self-doubt in
oh, no. no. I mean, it just, he needed to be placed in the setting where it would bloom. There's the frequent Easterner goes west theme. Occasionally they'd flip it, the Westerner would come east and then lick them all and show them. Alternating with some other personas, the Ruritanian romance, you know, I've become the leader of this middle yeah. European country that I didn't even know existed.
It happened.
It would happen to Doug. Mm-hmm. So there were some set pieces that became sort of standard themes that he played over and over again. And every so often he would do something just pretty straight, like Man from Painted Post was a straight Western when he'd already done a spoof of a Western in Wild and Woolly. So he was like Harold in that, you're right, we had this all-American brash persona, but he was different from Harold, again, because he was more heroic. Harold, Chaplin, Keaton, all of them found their heroism sort of in the last reel. And sometimes that would happen to Fairbanks, too, but I think he was pretty much our hero throughout. He made no, you know, no doubt he was a hero.
Yeah, he starts out, I mean, I was rereading my chapter on Knickerbocker Buckaroo, and I wrote it in a book called Lost Films, and was reading the synopsis in that. And it does start off when he just, he's pretty much himself. I mean, he's already fully bloomed as who he's going to be.
Yeah.
And he meets adversity, he has things to overcome, but he's already that guy.
He's already Doug, yeah.
Whereas you look at a Lloyd film like, say, The Freshman, and
he
nobody likes
himself,
him, he keeps failing, keeps embarrassing himself, things just keep going wrong until he figures out how to turn it around.
Right.
So that's the major thing, but I still, in terms of the persona of the go-getter, the not even the Horatio Alger kid, but the the all-American, full of pep, full of energy and optimism, and I think those two have a lot in common. And then, of course, once Fairbanks went to his costume dramas or costume adventures,
right?
He never really came back, at least during the silent era, to the
To
what he's done before.
He didn't really. By the time you're doing the talkie version of Reaching for the Moon, which is a modern dress film, he's not producing that. That's Joseph Schenck. He struck a deal with Schenck where if he liked the script, he would put his own money into it. But if he didn't like it, Schenck was paying. And he didn't like it. And so Schenck paid the bill, and Schenck ended up paying the piper. That thumping is not me. Yeah, that's a dog scratching. Of note is the pre swashbuckler film that was either his greatest failure or his second greatest failure, and he didn't have many failures in those films. Was a film that's a wonderful film called The Half-Breed, directed by Alan Dwan. It's rarely seen in its complete form. We're working on a restoration of it now. Rob Byrne, who's chair of the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, in conjunction with Serge Bromberg at Cinémathèque Française, and other talented people, what we're doing is we're aggregating the original Anita Loos titles from the Library of Congress print that had been up in Alaska in the swimming pool, and the beautiful quality print from a early reissue where the titles had been changed. And then Rohauer, back in the day, somehow managed to obtain an identical print with identical scratches, and then he dumbed down the titles even more to make it his own, which is now what the Cohen Media Group has. But the Cinémathèque has got the best print quality, and the titles, Anita Loos titles, are marvelous. But the film deals with racism against Native Americans. It has two strong and interesting female characters. And the least interesting thing about the film is Fairbanks' character. And golly, it turns out to be, you know, the triangle film that does not succeed. Great film, not a great Fairbanks film. And he never made that mistake again. The other film that lost money for his production company, shockingly enough, is Knickerbocker Buckaroo. And it's not because it wasn't a wonderful film, although if it's lost, we won't know. But we're on the hunt.
I urge you to find it.
I'm telling you, we've restored Mr. Fix-It. We're working on the Half-Breed, and anybody with an earshot, if you have something in your basement or garage, we're looking for it. But I think that's because he was switching from Paramount as a distributor to the formation of UA, and I think Paramount cooked the books a little to feed a little less profit his way, and it ran negative. That or else Fairbanks ran the expenses up to make it look like it didn't earn money. But that was the one of the art craft films that actually went in the red.
Interesting.
Yeah. Something was off about it. I haven't explored it. you do sort of a financial forensic job, and you end up finding a lot of lovely dirty secrets, some of which I could share, some of which will be in the book, and I sure don't want to share yet. But I find that studying the finances in the books leads you down some really interesting paths.
That's one part of the of film history that I've never seemed to get into much, mostly because I'm so bad with my own finances,
mm-hmm,
that financial stuff doesn't make that much sense to me. And so I'd probably see all sorts of interesting things and just not understand.
Well, Hollywood accounting is notoriously crooked.
Well, sure.
But if you get into a man's tax records or a production company's records, you will see that the people who are behind the scenes, not making publicity claims, you know, well, 50,000 horses, we spent $1 million on costumes. You'll see to the penny what they spent on Robin Hood, and you can break it down by categories, and you can see what the return is. And, of course, it takes about 3 years for a film to play all the distant markets,
sure,
and for the full return to come back. That's why it took so long for Thief of Baghdad to finally get beyond break-even. And you can see him reasoning, well, each year he'd invest more and more. You know, Musketeers cost more than The Nut and Zorro. Then he went way up with Robin Hood. That did just through the roof well. So then he goes way, way, way up, putting money into Thief of Baghdad, which that's his break point. That barely pays for itself. Then he backs down. He's a smart guy. He's not grandiose. He's not D.W. Griffith. He's a very smart businessman. And so he backs down and does Don Q, and that turns out to be tremendously profitable. We don't think of Don Q, Son of Zorro, as being a particularly sexy film, although you must admit that's a sexy poster.
It's a good poster. Yeah.
It's a very nice poster. But it was very good in terms of return to him, and then let him invest and turn in Technicolor and The Black Pirate.
Yeah.
But
did The Black Pirate do okay?
The Black Pirate, we don't have exact figures for, and unless I get them in the UA records in Wisconsin, which I haven't done yet. The reason is most of the figures I have right up to Don Q are from a tax dispute that Doug was having with the feds. And at the time of all the appeals and claims, we have all of the figures during the course of that dispute going back to 1917 with In Again, Out Again, his first film. After Don Q, we don't have the same records. And so I know it did well. Costs were much higher because of the Technicolor. And there were projection issues and having to create multiple prints because there was cupping of the release prints,
yeah,
that made focus a real problem. And that's why they decided not to do Gaucho in color,
yeah,
except for the little sequence with Mary.
Somebody once said to me, in all seriousness,
mm-hmm,
that they felt that Black Pirate probably didn't do as well as some of the others because many of the theaters didn't have color projectors.
Oh, my. All right, then. Well, you know, back in the
very
day...
Very astute, I thought.
So. Well, you know, in the Kinema Color days, that was meaningful.
Well, sure.
You had to have a special
Absolutely.
Projector. But not for Black Pirate. No.
But as you say, the dual-packed film
yeah.
was rough on projectors.
It and the film itself would cup and
it
bend.
It was thicker than normal, and it was
tough
hard,
on the projection.
Yeah, hard to
But were it not for Doug, Technicolor Corporation would not be around today. We really needed a major figure to make a feature, and he took it on when others would not. I mean, there had been one earlier feature with Anime Wong before, mm-hmm, but that was not a major.
Toll of the Sea.
Exactly right, which is on the AFI box set.
Yeah.
Lovely. But that had not... That was not what the company needed, and they really needed somebody, you know, a major figure to make a major film, and they did, and that kept them going.
Now, did Fairbanks say that Jackie Coogan had given him the idea to make Black Pirate? Who said that?
Jackie Coogan.
Jackie
said,
Coogan.
Yeah.
Said
I never, oh. I never, never, never trust That's like Mickey Rooney claiming that Walt Disney brought him in and said, oh, here's Mortimer Mouse. Well, maybe I'll name him Mickey instead, after you, kid. The trouble with biography, Hollywood biography, is that everybody lies. They lie, I don't think because they're malicious. I think they lie in part to self-promote, to self-aggrandize, and because it makes a better story. And these are dramatic storytellers. And so it makes more fun for Jackie Coogan, who probably did look at Howard Pyle photographs in Doug's house, to say, well, you know, he took that inspiration from
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I think I've talked about this with somebody before on this podcast.
Maybe Rudy Belmer, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But these people, like, you know, I've done a lot of work on Wellman, obviously, mm-hmm. And he was never lying exactly.
He was telling a good yarn.
But he always would structure something so that it came out as
a lovely narrative.
And
exactly.
So it had a good Sacco ending. Yeah. And it had good dialogue and I think that they just never expected people like us
to come in and really
to really
it.
Look.
Yeah.
And because when they were talking to the fan magazines and even the newspapers mm-hmm. in those days, that's what they wanted to hear. The right. newspapers didn't want to hear.
Nobody would fact check.
No.
Yeah. And
why should they?
Yeah.
Is Jackie Coogan having the idea for the Black Pirates a good story?
Yeah. Exactly.
So why not? And yep. even I bet had Jackie Coogan said that at the time, mm-hmm. I bet Fairbanks would have said he sure did.
That's right. Why not? You've yeah. got yeah hugely popular child
of
star
course.
That
sure.
his own best friend had brought into prominence. You know, Chaplin
yeah.
was Fairbanks' best friend. And that was an enduring friendship. And I think Chaplin relied on Doug more than the other way around, which is interesting. But
yeah, let's talk a little bit about United Artists.
Mm-hmm.
As I guess everybody knows, United Artists was formed by Fairbanks, Pickford, Chaplin, and D.W. Griffith.
Yes.
And it was very famously said, the lunatics have taken over the asylum. Accurately said? I don't know, but famously said. What's the genesis of that, and why did they decide to take control of things? Themselves?
Well, we have to remember United Artists is not a production company. It's a distribution company. And it was the only distribution company at the time when most of the integration was vertical that a studio production company would not only have the distributor, but would have the exhibition arm. So Famous Players Lasky was the studio. Paramount was the distributor, and then they had Paramount Theaters. United Artists was a distribution company that would cut a good deal to the artists. And it was the genesis was that there was a rumor that Paramount and First National were going to merge, and there would be sort of a monopoly on the market and no competition between production companies that would provide good salaries for these superstar artists. And by financing and distributing their productions themselves, they felt that they would get a larger piece of the pie. And in fact, they did. Fairbanks' personal income went up when he started collecting not just a actor's salary, but or the production company profits, but when he started getting the distributor's share. And as an idea, it was a very good one. The failure of United Artists, and it's been around for a long time, its weakness was that it did not have enough product. And so the very thing that they were opposed to, the production of mediocre, you know, filler movies, B movies, stuff to fulfill the contracts, was the thing that made it hard for them to keep going. And that's why they had to bring in Joseph Schenck, who then would bring in Sam Goldwyn and others to provide them with more product. But constantly they were searching for producers sort of their caliber. And then once Doug and Mary Oh my, those dogs are noisy. Once Doug and Mary are beyond their prime, then they're really in trouble, because then they have this internal quarrel of, well, yes, you're a founder and you may have 25% or 20% of the stock, but you're not producing any films. Therefore, what value are you bringing to the company? And thus, Sam Goldwyn staged some pretty bad temper tantrums. And
well, looking back at the very beginnings mm-hmm. of it, Griffith almost seems perversely to be the one who doesn't seem to fit.
Yes,
because he's. And is it only because we look at it in retrospect that we can see that he's already in serious decline by then?
No, I mean, Griffith was near his artistic decline, but he's not in it in 1919. He's just made his pastoral art crafts, you know, the True Heart Susie, yeah. Romance of Happy Valley. He has ahead of him still Way Down East, Orphans of the Storm.
And Way Down East was a huge popular,
huge hit. And there's Broken Blossoms as well. So he's about to go off the cliff, but he's still got some more good work to do. What Griffith is, and this is evident really from the start, is Griffith is not a good businessman. Think that when he moves from Biograph to Mutual, to Harry Aiken's company, he takes a huge cut in salary, what he could have had working for Jesse Lasky and Famous Players Lasky. They would have paid him a tremendous salary, but he would have not had control of the script. He would not have control of, you know, basically Paramount said, we'll produce the stories, thank you. This was in 1913. Instead, he goes with Harry Aiken for some like $300 a week. I think by the time 1915 came and he'd done Birth of a Nation and Fairbanks is on board, Griffith is making about $450 a week. This is when Fairbanks is making $10,000 a week working for the same company. But Griffith gets control, artistic control. And what Griffith is interested in is artistic control in the story, and does not really grasp the fact that if you don't have financial control, ultimately you will lose artistic control. His experience to date has been somebody will come in and bail me out. You know, Clune will come in and loan me money for Birth of a Nation. These films will succeed. Then I will move on. And for a while, for him, it worked until it didn't. And then you see the next 10, 15 years of his life becomes this slow downward decline as he loses control and ultimately, in the late 20s, becomes a studio director and loses his voice in a sense.
Yeah.
It's funny. I saw some, at Pordenone, I saw some of his late studio work. And some of it was like, oh, dear, Sorrows of Satan. I'm sorry to see this. But he made a film, oh, and I'm blanking on the name, with Jetta Goodall and Lupe Velez. And it's something about wages in the title or something. And that is as slickly made a studio product, as fluid a camera as you would ask to see. It astonished all of us who were seeing this kind of clunky Griffith through the mid to late 20s, occasional little bursts of the old guy, but who's clearly not keeping up and moving ahead with the times. And then all of a sudden you see just this absolutely glossy studio production as well. They played it. They were so impressed that it then showed in the San Francisco Silent Film Festival the following summer. And I tell you, I'm blanking on the title.
I am too. I don't know. This is. There must be some sort of cloud coming over the house.
Oh, it. If I got up and walked and grabbed a book, I'm sure I'd find it.
But. Hey, everybody at home, look it up.
Yeah.
That's what IMDb is for.
Yeah.
I've seen some of that mid to late 20s stuff, and what I've seen mostly has not worked. And then the sound films, it's weird. Both Abraham Lincoln and the alcoholic one.
Oh, God.
With Hal Skelly.
Yes, don't even say it. It's so
Zita
awful.
Zita Johann. It's... That looks like a biograph from 1912 with a soundtrack.
Oh, the biographs from 1912 were better. Much better. I mean it. It was such an embarrassment. And
then Abraham Lincoln has these flashes of great sequences here and there, but
mostly it's narrative set pieces.
Walter Huston, a great actor, is horrible in it. Yeah. And Una Merkel, who I love, is horrible in it. And
it's very sad.
Yeah, you got to lay that at Griffith's feet.
It'll be a double feature. You know, Griffith's Abraham Lincoln
and
Spielberg's The Struggle was the last one. Hal Skelly, that was. Oh, I saw that, and it was so bad that what they did when they showed it in Pordenone was the very next film they showed, I think to cheer everybody up, as they showed The Adventures of Dolly again. They took us back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And then we all felt better, but oh my. It was grim. But he wasn't producing for UA at this point. Now he's at Paramount. He's out of UA, and so he became a non-entity or a non-factor in United Artists before anybody else did, and also was a frustrating partner for them, taking things like Orphans of the Storm and running it as a roadshow for himself instead of distributing it through the company. And he did that because he was desperate for money. Again, he overspent, mismanaged, and sort of didn't learn his lessons, had been lucky. For every, you know, disaster he had, then suddenly along would come A Way Down East, and then he'd overspent on Orphans, and then he never had another big financial hit. I mean, Russell Merritt, I think, could come in and speak to Griffith far more intelligently than I can.
And I hope he will one of these days.
Oh, I'm sure he will. He's marvelous.
Yeah, I love Russell.
I want him to write that book.
Oh, me too.
Like, beating on him every time I see him. Russell is such a brilliant writer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he'll write a paragraph with ease, and the darn thing is so beautiful. It makes you weep. Once he spoke about biographs where he said, you know, children were lost as easily as hatpins. And, you know, the fortunes would come and go. And he just described this tight little narrative structure as beautifully as Griffith had directed one.
Yeah.
He described it, and I just wish I had his tongue. Well, let me tell you one wonderful book that's been written. Has been written by a man named David Mayer, who is a theatrical historian. But he wrote a book about D.W. Griffith's, the influence of theater on D.W. Griffith's films. So when he's talking about Way Down East, he's talking about William Brady's production.
Sure.
And the songs that are used in it and why Griffith included certain song titles. And the whole book, Orphans of the Storm, The Two Orphans, the whole book is as absorbing and intelligently written as you could want. And I'm so grateful when people who have this fund of knowledge do write their books, because I think society is, at large, doesn't reward them. It's just the geeks like us.
Yeah.
We only buy one copy each. I think we're probably, you know, it's hard to make a gratifying living doing that.
Well, that book sounds right up my alley, because I've always felt that the influence of theater on especially early film cannot be overemphasized and does not get as much examination as it should.
And that happens, I'm sorry to interrupt, happens with Fairbanks. In other words, Hawthorne of the USA essentially gets transplanted over and becomes His Majesty the American. You see Fairbanks' film plots re-echoed in his theater plots re-echoed in his films pretty directly. Obviously, his first film, The Lamb, can't be a direct steal from the new Henrietta or the Henrietta, but it's as close as you can get in terms of the theme and the character. They give him a different name, but they call him the Lamb, and of course in the original play he was Bertie the Lamb. And you get, in Fairbanks' case, one direct transfer, which was He Comes Up Smiling, which was a 1914 play that he did. It was the only play he did that got transferred directly to a book. which is why I chose it for the subtitle for my biography.
But I was thinking even on film technique, mm-hmm. the influence of theater is immense.
Oh, yes. In the early years, very
much. Yeah, when you watch, it's not only, you know, people will often talk about silent movie acting mm-hmm. with broad gestures and that sort of thing. That's all theater stuff. That's
right.
Not silent movie acting.
Right.
That's
the discard.
That's what they're bringing from
yeah.
the stage.
And they gradually migrated over. And
yeah.
again, the influence of Frederick Ward on Fairbanks, who was a teenager when he was touring with them, absolutely can be seen if you see Frederick Ward and Richard the Third. Which was a lost Shakespeare film that was discovered, I'd say, about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think about that.
And you watch it and you're going, oh, my God, this is dreadful. But you're missing, of course, his rich, throaty voice and enunciations
sure.
and that just captivated, I won't say rural audiences, I'll say semi-urban audiences. I mean, Ward would not play New York and Chicago. He would play Detroit and little places like Los mm-hmm. Angeles in those years, semi-urbanized rubes were.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, he was just...
Those rubes, and I mm-hmm. and I contend that the rubes that continue to populate this world like to know that they're seeing acting.
Yes.
And all you have to do is look at any Academy Awards ceremony ever, and you'll see that the awards go often to fine actors. I'm not denigrating anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they always go to roles in which the people are really acting.
That's right. There's nothing subtle going
yeah.
on. Yeah.
And even John Wayne, who I revere,
yes,
gets his Academy Award when he puts on the eye patch and he's, you know...
Mm-hmm. It helps also if you're dying or never...
Something different from what people expected him to be or commenting on that. So that's another thing that I think about a lot, because when we see early sound stuff, and I mean even in early in the 20s when they were first starting to experiment with sound,
mm-hmm.
the speech pattern seemed to be very big and dramatic
and
drawn out.
It's like the sequence in Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
You know, the
But I contend that that's what people wanted. They wanted to hear acting. They didn't want somebody to sound like their next-door neighbor.
Right. They didn't want Marlon Brando mumbling.
No.
And, in fact, we didn't get Marlon Brando mumbling until the 50s.
Yeah.
And even then, people objected that our naturalism. They wanted clear enunciation and speech that was unnaturally perfect with no parenthetical asides or ums or hums and... Yeah.
And it's interesting because what you were saying about Doug earlier mm-hmm. is how natural people found him at the time. And I'm certain he would not seem natural were we to see him now. But it's something that audiences always fool themselves on, because if we watch, say, a sitcom on TV,
mm-hmm.
say Big Bang Theory, and we watch that and we think, well, they're funnier than people are in real life. But otherwise, they're talking like we talk. No, they're not. They're not talking like we talk at all.
Right.
There's a stylized
mm-hmm.
cadence to the way they talk.
Nobody
and the way
interrupts.
They deliver.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's why Howard Hawks was so interesting, because he had that overlapping speech, which people didn't up until that time.
Yeah, there were always people who were trying to get it, because what we respond to in a lot of these people is... the naturalism that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, why do you like Myrna Loy so much, you know, and, but nevertheless, she had this very stylized accent.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, it's not natural at all,
but
she
it
comes
tricks
across.
Us.
And,
yes.
Yeah. It tricks us.
William Powell.
Yeah.
They're brilliant. Well, I remember sitting next to someone at the Iron Mask screening in San Francisco, where they were playing the original Fairbanks voice, because, as you may remember, those discs had been lost for a while. And the person leaned next to me as he was standing there, you know, saying his words about times of old and rolling his R's, and said, was he really that bad? And the answer is, in 1929, he was really that good.
Yeah.
That
was not bad.
That was not bad. And as long as we understand that they're functioning within conventions, like is it kabuki drama? You know, and
sure.
That they're operating within a set of rules, and the rules have since changed on us. You can see Mary Pickford in 1912 give two totally different performances in Biographs. The New York Hat, where she is as subtle and natural and wonderful as could be. And then there was one in April of that year with Claire McDowell and Mary Pickford and a third woman out in the desert. And I forget why they're trapped in the desert and they're all killing each other. I just remember that it happened to be released the same day that the Titanic sank, which is why it's stuck in my head. And, oh, my God, they're chewing up the scenery by our standards. But they're giving... they're on the cusp of this change in an acting style, and so they're giving a pre-1912 performance, all three of them, and yet that very a few months later in the summer she's giving a naturalistic performance, and it is, I'm sure, a conscious decision.
Sure.
And Fairbanks in The Lamb has one scene where he's mostly just charming and natural, and he's enacting his hugely critically acclaimed performance as Bertie in The New Henrietta, and we get to see it on the screen. He's doing this wonderful, subtle job of being the anti-Fairbanks, of being shy and nervous and hesitant. But there's this one scene where he is in remorse, having remorse over the fact that he failed to rescue somebody in a drowning episode, and somebody else made the rescue, and he looks like a coward. And his arms fling up and his mouth opens wide and he throws himself down in the sand, and you're going, what did Christy Cabanet make this man do? And it's so at odds with the rest of his performance, but it's not unusual even for as late as 1915 to see this. So I think in 1915 it would not have struck the audience as odd as it did today, but we see nothing quite that off for the rest of his career, even though we see stylized theatrical performances, nothing nearly as bad as that one shot.
I think that's one of the reasons that Doug continues to be so accessible to people, because he does just tend to come across as himself.
Alistair Cook wrote that he was the greatest fusion of a screen persona and a person, that either he was the best actor of all time, or they really was, they were one and the same. And I think he's right. Douglas was not the best actor of all time. They really were one and the same. This was what the guy was like, hiding and omitting, of course, his dark moments. And even then we get a glimpse of them in some sequences, like in The Gaucho. There he gives a performance of a man who has an underlying hurt with great modernity and subtlety, so much so that when he's playing a drunk scene, Richard Schickel thought, oh, he's off his game. Look, he was this steadying, you know, he had to steady himself on the steps. Like, no, he was drunk. See, that's why he had this, the character was drunk. That people just think Doug is so Doug that he couldn't act drunk. Of course, he's done many a wonderful drunk scene in Again, Out Again, Double Trouble, which otherwise has very few charms. It was his second film for Triangle, but he has a marvelous drunk scene in that. But this was not a comic drunk scene. This was, he was a tortured man who was drunk, and people just didn't believe.
Mary Pickford is, to me, as good an actress as anybody in the silent era, and I don't even know why I would lock her up there, but I can always tell that she's acting to a certain extent. I think she was a great technician, and I think she's incredibly appealing and convincing and everything that acting needs to be, but I can always kind of see it happening. Whereas with Doug, I can't necessarily see it happening. It almost seems, I think that's why he just comes off as being a natural himself.
Well, Mary Pickford in real life, of course, was an astute businesswoman who had a couple of marriages and some love affairs under her belt. And so if she's portraying a little girl, you know, she has to be acting. What I notice about Mary is that in the silent era, when you see her performance, you absolutely lock in and commune with her. It becomes, sacred's too strong a word, everybody's going to laugh at me, but there becomes this moment where you're just one with her performance. In Sparrows, when she encounters the dead baby in her arms and realizes that the child has died, the flash of emotions across her face between, you know, astonishment and grief and sorrow and then understanding, happens in micro expressions, but it's phenomenal. I find that when you get her in sound, you're distracted by her little voice. And again, her theatrical playing, because she also comes from a different tradition. And I will turn off the sound in films like Taming of the Shrew and find once again a brilliant Pickford performance. But when I hear her, especially in something like Coquette, oh my gosh, you know, you grieve for what you once had, but you also realize that that sound makes us see and communicate with the performer in a different way. Silence does in a different way than does sound in silence. And Fairbanks, once sound technically caught up, because sound films are pretty rocky through many of these early years, but once the technology caught up, Fairbanks is pretty good. Sound and a natural style of performance work for him. Mary, I think we lost something wonderful when sound came her way. On the other hand, Fred Astaire in a silent movie lacks charms too. So, you know, we just have to recognize different types of performance are optimized in different environments. And I feel never quite so much as with Mary Pickford. And even Buster Keaton, that wonderful still face. It's not. I know he had a good voice, but it's just not the same.
He seems weighted down in some way. It seems
projection speed. I think you're right. It's you hear every thump on those early sound comedies, the stunts, the gags that used to be. These elfin figures were flying through the air. Suddenly they thump and it looks like it hurts. And at least for me and maybe for all the other women in the audience, that's not as funny. Men like Three Stooges, they like the thumps.
But Three Stooges are hugely outsized thumps.
Yes, they're cartoony thumps. Yeah, they're not.
I think it was Walter Kerr who was writing about Harold Lloyd when he turned to sound. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Kerr, who says in Feet First, when he's recreating a lot of the climbing stuff in Safety Last, but this time he's horrified and he's
you hear him crying,
screaming
out.
And crying out, and that in itself is not funny.
Yep.
It's just when you see somebody being terrified yet doing funny things, it works.
Yeah,
but when you think,
you hear
I hope I don't fall.
Yeah,
then you think, oh, I'm worried about that guy, and that's not funny.
Yeah, I'm with him on that one. Yeah. I think. True silent films, that union of sound and image, of music and image, is different from a talking film where your brain, the part of your brain that processes speech is a different part of your brain that processes sound and music. And so I think you relate to a silent film differently than you relate to a talking film. And some of the best talking films have extended sequences without words. Think of the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan.
Sure.
But even after the beach sequence, there's a prolonged sequence where we're watching all the women typing the condolence letters in a government office, and then we see a woman in a silent film sequence recognize that there are three names going to the same address. And she does this, and we watch her bring it into her bosses. There's a brief sound sequence where they say, oh, my goodness, yes, this family. And then, again, we revert to silence as we have a mother at a sink and a car comes down the road, and she's clearly rural, and then she sees a chaplain and an officer get out, and she drops to her knees. Purely a silent film sequence. The cheesy movies do it with a bad music soundtrack underneath. Good movies do it without a theme song. But most movies have a sequence portion that is sustained without dialogue. And those filmmakers, I think, are reverting back to that which is good about films, non-musical films.
Well, I often judge how good a director's technique is by how much he can shoot without dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can tell a story with images, then you're telling a story cinematically.
Right.
And that's entirely what the silent era was.
Yep. It's the opposite of My Dinner with Andre.
Exactly the opposite. But that's why so many of, you know, you look at all those guys who came out of the silent era, and they virtually created the sound era,
yep.
But they all knew how to tell a story with pictures first.
Victor Fleming in Gone with the Wind starts with Scarlett O'Hara walking through a train yard and then pulls the camera back as we see the extended field of soldiers, and then finally the waving Confederate flag, and that flag is tattered. That's telling the story of a failed war with a single visual. D.W. Griffith argued he did the same thing with a few shots of dead bodies, but it doesn't matter which choice you make. Both choices are visual and without written words.
Yeah,
and it's you're down to quibbling at this point.
I always got the idea that Griffith was making the same argument that you now hear people saying, well, you know, when they made Cleopatra, they actually had 40,000 people on the set. They didn't have all this computer stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the same thing. I mean, it's you can make art with whatever tools you have.
When DeMille made Cleopatra, he did it with, 40 extras on the set, and they just it still looked like a crowd, and then he would say, oh, we didn't need to spend the money that Fox spent in 63, I think it was. And
well, of course, nobody needed to spend the money.
Not even Fox.
No.
Foolish, very foolish. But which leads us to your theme of lost films, the Theda Bara Cleopatra. Will it ever turn up in some Russian?
Wouldn't that be nice if it did? I was looking at some stills just the other day, because I had a bunch, and when I did the lost film book, they only put in two or three.
Yeah.
And I had a whole bunch of them. Production shots and everything, and it just looked fun. Now, Theda Bara is another one of those people that we may never really properly characterize for ourselves.
Sure.
Because so little of what she did survives.
I'm amazed we have a fool there was.
Yeah.
And not
in a very good print. At least I've never seen a good print. So we don't have that much of her, and we don't. All we can rely on is what other people said about her.
What's shocking to me, and this brings the subject back to Fairbanks, is how much of Fairbanks is lost. And these were films that he preserved and saved, but that subsequent hands did not handle properly. I mean, he turned his films over to the Museum of Modern Art. Paramount retained rights to some of those films. And somewhere along the line, they lost them. And so films like Arizona, which, probably was the least of Fairbanks' self-produced silent films, not critically very acclaimed, but partially directed by Fairbanks. Films like Heading South, the only smidgen of Heading South that exists is in a compilation film Paramount did in the early 30s, The House That Shadows Built. People did not take care of what they had, even for these major stars. And it's very disappointing to me that so much of their good work, even when it does exist, is not available for people to see. Kevin Brownlow has never seen In Again, Out Again, because MoMA will only project the print. They won't put it on DVD. anything. And here is one of the most charming Fairbanks Anita Loos, John Emerson films that even the great Kevin Brownlow can't see, because if he's not in New York the day they project it.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, it's a real shame. There, I mean, I go on both sides of this story. Obviously, the subject of lost films is of interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I also recognize that there are enough silent films that exist that I'll never watch them all. I'll never be able to see all of them. So in some ways, my life is pretty much stocked with more than I could ever see.
But
it's just the specific things that I want to see.
Yeah, if you were interested in Charles Dickens, what would it be like to have half of the chapters of Oliver Twist missing, all of, you know, Dombey and Son gone, and Our Mutual Friend is, you know, just a rumor. I think people, if any particular artist, they need to be able to see the as complete a collection of their work as possible. And if I can read everything that Hemingway wrote, I may have to dig around some libraries to find some magazine articles. Compilations may not have been done, but nobody's burned every magazine that article was in. Yeah. And yet, the only way anybody could have seen all of the Griffith biographs that exist, and they don't all exist, would be to be lucky enough to be in Pordenone, Italy between 1997 and 2007. That's a shame, because only the affluent or the lucky are in that position.
And I'm neither.
But you're good looking. And
everybody says so.
That's the rumor. And yet this is something that's withheld from people, and I think that's a terrible pity. And it's not the case for sound films. Most sound films we can get that are not lost, and there are still a few sound films, studio films that are lost. But for the most part, you may have to go into Warner Archives and buy yourself a copy, or wait till TCM shows it. But they're there. Silent films, they just burn them for the silver.
Yeah.
And it's a grievous thing to think that a star of the caliber of Fairbanks or Pickford could still have lost films today.
And even they're luckier than many.
Yes.
There are some people, Theda Bara, let's go back to her.
Theda Bara.
We've got virtually nothing, a couple of films.
There was her second to last film. I know David Shepherd restored back in the 70s.
I think we've got two or three at most.
Yeah.
And then I remember I did an article on George Lone Tucker, who directed The Miracle Man with Lon Chaney.
Uh-huh.
When he died, Photoplay magazine called him the first of the immortals. They said he was one of the great artists of the cinema. We've got like one film, maybe two.
Yeah. And for Miracle Man, there's just the two little clips.
Yes, the little clips. Yeah.
And I think they also were recovered from The House That Shadows Built.
Yeah.
And if that hadn't been, you know. So what happened between, you know, 1931 or two, when they made that anniversary film, and modern day? I still wonder if we went in with pickaxes and headlamps into Paramount's vaults, if we'd find them just in mislabeled cans.
There are still things out there that, and even in the vaults.
Yeah.
I was talking with John Marsalis about this, because I asked him if it was a true story, because I've heard it so much, that there is a Lon Chaney film called The Unknown. And it existed, I believe, in the Cinémathèque Française, I believe.
Henri Langlois.
For years.
Yeah.
And it was on the shelves.
And dissolved.
The Unknown. No, it exists. But it was labeled The Unknown, because that's the name of the film.
Yes.
But people kept looking at it and
thinking it was
one of these days we got to figure out what this
film is. But that film is, oh no!
So years go by, and then finally somebody says, I'm going to find out what this thing is. And of course, it's the Lon Chaney film, The Unknown. So it was always right there. I'm sure there are other things like that that will be as funny.
Well, the missing
stories,
footage from Metropolis.
Yeah.
Metropolis, when I don't know why, I just couldn't get into it. I saw various restorations until finally I saw the print with the additional 16mm footage. And suddenly the missing pieces of the puzzle, the story fell into place. It made more sense to me. And I thought, this is a great, epic film. Whereas before it had been sort of an annoying science fiction parable. And, you know, the same has got to be true for many other films where, you know, if we could just see them. And even if we see them and they're mediocre, and I'm one of the, in a minority, I thought John Ford's Upstream was a pretty boring little programmer. I think Ford
I enjoyed it a lot.
It's because it was a lost film. But
no, I actually went to it thinking, well, it's lost. I'm going to see it.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting much. And so I thought it was much...
I was surprised by it. I was underwhelmed. And yet I want to see when John Ford makes what is to me an underwhelming film. You know, this is not How Green Was My Valley. This was a little film about, you know, a boarding house. And that's okay, because that's part of his narrative, too, is when he makes little films or programmers, and, you know, sometimes you're handed a script by a studio, and you're not an auteur. You make what they give you to make.
And also, it's something that's impossible to explain to the normals, but for people like us...
Uh-huh.
You know, if you found a Lost Fairbanks film, would you care at all if it was good or bad? No.
No,
I would just
want to
see it.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a good movie is almost irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You want to fit that piece back into the puzzle. You want to round out what you know.
Absolutely. You know, the thrill of seeing Mr. Fix-It, which is a minor film. It was entirely studio bound. They made it in a great hurry because he was leaving to do the Bond rally in 1918. And yet still, there are delightful little things to see in it. For example, he never goes down the flight of steps the same way twice. I think there are six different ways he goes down the flight of steps in this studio set. You know, there's a mansion with a big center hall steps. And that in itself made it worth seeing and worth the restoration. So the more we can make these films accessible to everybody, the good, the bad.
I agree.
The ugly, the better we are.
Yeah, every once in a while somebody will say to me, hey, I saw this this Wellman film's coming up, Lafayette Escadrille, should I watch it? And I always think, I have no idea what to tell you. Because when I watch it, because it's literally about Wellman's life as a flyer in World War I, with his son playing himself, and all of the stuff that actually happened to him, then it's got all this...
Resonance
to me.
Right.
That it's not going to have to somebody else. Mm-hmm. Is it a good movie or a bad movie? I don't know. I can't tell you.
Yeah,
I know that I like watching it.
What year was it made?
It was made in 56. It was released in 58. It was the last film of his that was released.
Now, wasn't there some doubt, or Louise Brooks or somebody had questioned whether he actually had been in the Lafayette Escadrille?
He wasn't in the Lafayette Escadrille, which was he was in the Lafayette Flying Corps, which was the offshoot of the Escadrille. He claims to have been outraged when Warners insisted on calling the movie Lafayette Escadrille.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he was that outraged.
Okay.
His title was C'est la guerre. But, he often got incrementally more outraged as he got older and older and farther away from Warner Brothers. And then by the time he's 70 years old, he's threatening to kill Jack Warner and all this stuff. Those stories just keep getting better and better, as you know.
Well.
But speaking of Wellman, I was wondering about the Fairbanks connection there, because Wellman always said that he met Fairbanks in Boston.
In Boston, as a hockey player.
When he was playing hockey. And Fairbanks was in Hawthorne of the USA. And then he would come to watch Wellman and his team play, and because Wellman was a down-and-dirty player, Fairbanks liked him, introduced himself, said, hey, if you're ever out in Hollywood...
I've never known
if there's anything...
Well, of course...
Yeah, except he wasn't in Hollywood.
Yeah, in 1912. Yeah. I would have to go back and look at my theater notes to see if Hawthorne went through Boston.
It did.
Then
it played at the... it was that theater, Colonial Theater.
Okay, not the
right
Tremont.
Colonial Theater right there on the Common.
Believe it or not, I have a pretty good collection of theater programs for Doug, going back to 1905, which is pretty neat because you get a sense. One thing I have actually, sometimes you get people's scrapbooks with the programs glued in there, and they have little notes about the film. There was one young woman in 1905 who saw him in a play and underlined his name like 11 times and wrote, "Douglas Fairbanks, simply great." The leading lady was too old. I suspect she was probably 19 or 20.
Sure.
But, yeah, that doesn't make sense, the, hey, if you ever come to Hollywood business, because Doug was 3 years removed, and Hollywood itself was not a phenomenon.
And Wellman, in 1912, would have been 16, I guess?
Yeah. I think he was more interested in Wellman after the war. You know, now you have a young flyer. And
yeah, but without that original story, then you
got
to wonder...
You've got no connection.
How did they even know each other?
Right.
So,
and how could Doug go to hockey games unless they were daytime games, I guess?
They were. I think they were just kids playing.
Yeah.
And
you know.
So, yeah, I don't really have any problem with that part. But every other part of it, I just think...
Yeah,
but as
it's
I say, Wellman wasn't really a liar.
No, but you know, stories...
He would construct a story based on a foundation of something real.
He met him, probably, and then later parlayed that into, do you remember meeting me in Boston? But I think, you know, one of the biggest story fabricators was Alan Dwan.
Ah, yeah.
Alan Dwan would take a story, you know, by the time it's... 1962, you know, his Robin Hood narrative is like this. But if you get a transcript of what he had to say in 1922 to some Columbia University students, it's a totally far more realistic and less dramatic narrative. So by the time Alan Dwan is being interviewed by Peter Bogdanovich, you know, there are lions. Griffith is bringing a lion onto the Triangle set and frightening Fairbanks, and I forget who he was, I think Dwan, you know, sitting on a step, and Griffith comes with, "Here, kitty, kitty." you know, just stuff where you go, I don't remember a lion in Griffith Productions. It just becomes, again, good storytellers telling good stories and getting down to the reality as a historian is a challenge, but again, I found pretty uniformly the reality to be more interesting.
It's always, me too, but I have this, it's almost like, I keep circling around and I can't figure out where to land. When I went to ask one of my nephews when he was a little kid if they taught him in school about George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. And he said, "What's that? I have no idea what that is." So I told him the story, and he said, "Nobody ever told me that." So he's in like the third or fourth grade, something like that. And I thought, okay, it's not a true story.
But it's a myth.
It's a doorway to the to the real story. And it's like Santa Claus. It's okay to know about Santa Claus.
No, what about
until
Santa
you
Claus?
Learn that he's absolutely real.
Okay, good. You had me nervous.
No,
for a
of course,
second.
No. I'm sorry for scaring you that way.
Yeah, there are some people who've hinted, but I'm sure they're
no. Don't believe them.
Okay.
But in some ways, like during the '70s, there was a huge spate of this stuff: Capra's book, Raoul Walsh's book, Wellman's book, Miriam Cooper's Dark Lady of the Silence, and more. There were plenty of these books coming out, all completely unreliable in almost every detail.
Yeah.
And yet, in some way, as a researcher...
They captured an essence of truth.
Captured an essence, but also gave me a place to put my foot while I was climbing over to find out
the truth.
Where the real story was. And gave me that foothold in a way that might not have happened otherwise. And also, I think more to the point, gave an enthusiasm to the story.
Sure.
That you might not have if it were just dry facts.
Well, can we say the same has happened for Fairbanks? In other words, you've got his niece's narrative in the 50s, then Schickel's narrative in the early 70s. And Schickel's narrative is heavily informed by family myth and stories that Doug told about himself. By the time you get to Jeffrey Vance's book, which is far more accurate than any of the previously published works, you know, we're down to getting history from records as opposed to history from word of mouth. And the Schickel book remains to this day extremely readable to me. I just don't trust it as far as I can throw it and have fun, you know, discrediting this story or that story. I'm sure Richard Schickel, at least I have to hope he doesn't listen to this podcast, although he was my inspiration as a kid. I mean, he was actually the real reason I think I got interested in Douglas Fairbanks was in 1971 or two, he wrote an American Heritage article about him that then he later expanded into a short book called His Picture in the Papers, which was a narrative of Fairbanks's life, but was mostly a discussion on the phenomenon of celebrity and modern celebrity and how Fairbanks shaped it and what it means. With a lot of comparisons to sort of early 70s people that themselves now seem quaint and long ago. But that whole arc of reality, which then goes to myth, which now is reverting back to reality again as the Kevin Brownlows bring out the serious historians, I think is one that serves us all. Well, you're right. We did get our gateway drug, and now we're getting our truth.
Yeah, it's you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
You want the enthusiasm. You want the interest. Like, I've given talks many times because I've, for my sins, I've written 5 books related to the Alamo. And so I've often given talks on history and myth and all that stuff because there's hardly a historical event as mythologized as that.
There's Martyrs of the Alamo. Most there's John Wayne.
Many, many, many.
By the way, Doug was not in Martyrs of the Alamo.
Yes, I figured that out long ago.
Yeah, and yet they still list that on a filmography.
Yeah.
I've got evidence that the negative was, you know, put away and in bed long before he signed up.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually went through that print frame by frame.
Just looking, so did I.
Just trying to figure it out, and he is not in there.
No, especially the horse riding sequences, the crowds, I was like, because I can recognize him by, again, I'm going to be a doctor, by a kyphosis in his, between his C-spine and his T-spine. He has a characteristic curve of the neck that makes it very easy for me to see from the back whether that's Doug or not Doug.
Hmm.
And I'll tell you, 99 times out of 100, it's Doug. There are very few times when I freeze a frame in a stunt where it's possibly not Doug, where I'm going, that might be, you know, Talmadge, Richard Talmadge, you know, stepping in for him. But most of the time, nobody can reproduce that kind of unique curve. And
what do you think would have made Fairbanks back off from his stunt?
There were
really thought it was too dangerous to
no,
risk.
No, my favorite example of Fairbanks not being involved in the stunt is one that Mary Astor gives in Don Q, Son of Zorro, where again, as he gets, if as it's his money and the production is centered around him, he's got this. Two opposing forces. One is he's got to be the guy doing the stunts and be seen as the guy doing the stunts. But whenever possible for something where he could be hurt, but it's not a major thing, you know, throw another guy into the uniform and let him do it. So there was a stuntman doing a leap from a wall onto a horse. Because I guess if Doug gets his cojones, they're not going to be filming for a while. And the guy just can't do it, and he's in the Don Q costume. He's having trouble. So Fairbanks comes in and says, no, you know, here's how you do it. there's this trick. Here's how you do it. Boop! Gets on the horse and rides off. And the cameraman, of course, throwing up his hands, because if he'd just been in costume, they would have had the shot, and they'd have had the shot with Fairbanks. And the guy who's not supposed to be endangering himself just did the stunt. Thank you very much. So any stunt that he didn't do, it's very, very reasonable to say he was capable of doing. Some of the vine swinging shots in the Gaucho. I think if Rudy Belmer and I sat down and did a frame by frame on Black Pirate, I'm pretty confident I could convince him that, you know, 99% of the time that is Doug based on the kyphosis on the spine. But there's some shots where I'm just not sure. But if he's done a rope-to-rope swinging shot and it's him three shots before, it's likely him three shots later. But yeah. I can't say it with certainty. But that's something that people ask a lot. They don't usually know to look for that little deformity.
I certainly wouldn't
have. That's okay. That's why I went to medical
school. Now I feel so stupid.
No, you don't. No.
When I'm watching a film, I think the Fairbanks I most recently saw in 35mm was The Iron Mask.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always impressed just how skillful these guys were at every level of movie making. Because certainly Fairbanks is a brilliant acrobat and he's great with the stunt, but it's also quite clear, if you think about it or look at it, that they build these sets for him to do specific stunts.
Right. Dwan says the furniture's cut at a certain
height,
so it's graceful.
Yeah, everything, right. If he's going to climb up a wall in five different sections, everything is exactly where it needs to be. And I just always think of how meticulous they were.
Although in the early films,
everything right.
In the early films, he just climbed the walls.
I'm sure he did.
You know, in the fine arts and the triangles, they didn't build special walls for him to do. He just did it. And then Dwan's reasoning was, knowing that he can do this stunt, even jump even further or higher, let's have it be just high enough that it looks graceful. And The Iron Mask has a lot less stunting in it than many of his other films. But looking at the outtakes, which are available on the Brownlow DVD, I'm always amazed at what hard work it was. You see them shot after shot doing the same sword fight, shot after shot bursting through the door, coming through the window, because they're getting it from multiple angles, multiple takes, and, you know, this is work. I mean, he had to run in. You'll see little action sequences that are trimmed. If you break into a room and then get the villain. In fact, in a longer version, he broke through the room, fought a man on the bed, broke through the door with a chair, and then got the villain. Well, they just cut, you know, and made it flow better and more quickly. But outtakes on Robin Hood show the same thing. And the most interesting thing about the outtakes on Black Pirate, to me, is you would see shot after shot of him standing on the, you know, the edge of the ship, up on, I guess, on the quarterdeck, wherever it was, and then speaking to the pirate crew. And his arms would swing in dramatic gestures. But every shot, it's exactly the same. Every take, it's exactly the same. In fact, I always just sort of pictured Doug's arms waving around in general effusive Doug enthusiasm. But no, that was as structured a performance as a ballet in terms of arm movements. Just when he's giving a speech and gesticulating to the crew of men, not merely or not simply when he's doing some fabulous acrobatic stunt where I would expect the movements to be extremely standardized to be safe.
Yeah.
So these people worked hard. And you can see the intense concentration on his face. Often the clapboard goes down and you'll see him walking away from the failed shot and he's thinking. You get some sense of behind-the-scenes laughter and the Robin Hood outtakes. But the most memorable thing to me about the Robin Hood outtakes, there's a shot in the film, and it's broken up into two or three smaller shots of him scooping up Charles Stevens in a bow, as in bow and arrow, and then lifting him bodily up with the bow and hanging him from a hook on the ceiling. And Charlie Stevens was not a huge man, but the guy had to weigh, you know, 120, 140 pounds. He's a full-grown man. And for Doug to run, scoop him up, lift, and then hang him in a single motion, you see that done repeated takes, lifting Charlie up, and it was hard to get it smooth. He would lift this man up over and over, but to run and hook him at the same time. And if you look at the final print, you'll see they do break it down into three shots where they do a better close-up when he hooks him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because after about 20 takes, he just couldn't do it. But you have a sense of the incredible physical labor this man went through to produce that which seems so effortless.
Sure.
So there were things that Dwan did, particularly Dwan did, in terms of how he designed and cut the sets, because Dwan had an engineering background, if you think about it, that made Doug look graceful and elegant. But there was also a lot of brute sweat, and you can see in some shots the sweat under his armpit.
Well, there had to be. Well, that's what I was saying. Not that they were making it easy for him, but they were
making it graceful.
It was part of the choreography of what they were doing. Yeah. It was the difference between, oh, there's a garden wall, go jump over it, but something has to be revealed about yourself and your physicality
and sailing
as you go
over it.
Yeah,
to sail over it like a flying sprite.
It's a different thing.
It is.
And I often wonder, I don't know if you've ever seen any films by Jackie Chan, but often at the end of the films, they'll just have an outtake thing, and they're all just him getting hurt.
And
just
you see him,
after another.
You saw him break his ankle.
And I think there's got to be, if you had that many outtakes of Fairbanks, there's got to be just him hurting himself all the time.
Well, Rudy Belmer narrates some wonderful Black Pirate outtakes, and in fact, he gets cut in one of the sword fights on his arm, and you can see him. And I have documentary evidence of a lot of injuries, including breaking his hand during the filming of The Mollycoddle, where he gets into, or his people do, get into a big fight with the Internal Revenue Service, who won't let him write off the $80 doctor's bill. And they're saying, look, Fairbanks gets hurt all the time, but when he's hurt in conjunction with making a film, if the horse had been hurt, you would have let us write off the vet bill. Write off this stupid... And I mean, the IRS was going, no, that's a medical... But I have lots of stills of him with things wrapped in bandages, and he really did get some real wear and tear. But he earned it honestly. Oh my God!
Oh yeah!
And to see him with an audience, I've seen The Mark of Zorro. I don't want to tell you how many times because I had it as an 8mm film as a kid. But Leonard Maltin wrote in his blog after coming in the tail end in San Francisco and seeing it. He skipped the showing because he's also seen it, I'm sure, about 1,000 times. And he said, I wish I had been there for the whole thing because people were cheering and roaring and laughing and getting all the visual puns and the jokes. And it really was a delight, as is Fairbanks.
That's like a great way to stop this interview.
I agree. This is a long one. You can stop there. How long have we been talking?
We've been talking for 7 hours.
Oh, I knew it. You said 7 hours.
Yep, I knew. I always like to go in expecting 7 hours so that when we finally do it, you've got nothing to beef about.
That's right.
Well, Tracy, thank you very much. It's been great fun talking.
Thank you.
We've got to do this again. There's lots more Fairbanks to talk about.
Oh, and we haven't even talked about the collection here, but I guess when you're doing something that's audio and not visual, it's hard to share.
Well, I've thought about that. We might, next time we'll do one where we just walk around and you say, and here's a poster of the Black Pirate.
Yes, right. Both of them, in fact.
And the listeners will be intrigued.
Yeah, no, they'll break into my house and steal the goods. Well, I brought the boots.
For the record, you live in Montana.
That's right. I brought the boots to the Robin Hood showing, the 90th anniversary at the Egyptian.
Tell what those are.
A week ago. I have his original boots from Robin Hood. And afterwards, people all came and lined up and touched them and took pictures with them. Because you can't hurt a pair of leather boots. But, you know, I think if they were the ruby slippers, the sequins would break off. But people really enjoyed getting a chance to hold them and pose with them and look at the backs and look underneath and see the hobnails and stuff. It was marvelous.
It's great to see them, and it's great. Your collection is just so phenomenal. I could just stand here in this one room
and be happy.
Stare at the walls for hours and hours and hours. And I might do that, so just go ahead and go to bed.
That's right, I shall. If I wake up in the morning and the love letters are gone,
here,
I know, I'll be in trouble.
Oh, no, I'm an intruder, but I'm not a thief.
So, very good.
I'll just stand here and look.
Yeah. The thief of West Hollywood.
Well, thank you very much. We'll
thank
do it again,
indeed.
Okay?
Yes, we shall. Bye-bye.
That was a fun interview as far as I was concerned, and I could have let it gone on for a whole lot longer. But since it probably is one of the longest we've ever done, I will make my closing remarks brief as well. I'll simply thank Claire McCullough, my announcer, James Hutchin, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and also my personal website, frankthompson.tv. Please visit them both, shan't you? I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for providing my wonderful and poignant theme music. I also want to urge you to go to iTunes, leave me a good rating there on iTunes, because that really does help attract more people to the podcast. And more people is what I crave at this moment. I definitely need to build a bigger audience, and that's the way you can help. And if you leave a nice comment, better still, that would be wonderful. If you don't have anything nice to say, just leave a 5-star review and pretend you said something bad, and then everybody will be happy. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. I hope I will see you then. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.